Loss of the Kursk, K-141, a sub-brief. Start by going over our sources. We have the usual suspects here coming through again for us, like Saturn X-1, 800 tons naval art with the great cover art we just saw. H.I. Sutton, a submarine expert that helps me on these. Embers of Stern, who has a great drawing of the Oscar submarine sail that we're going to see here shortly. Some great websites that I use to fact check each other are deepstorm.ru, a Russian perspective website of Russian submarine operations, the Federation of American Scientists, which is an American perspective of nuclear-powered events, including the Kursk disaster, and Roshchikaya Gazette, or RGRU, a Russian newspaper, that published the Russian investigation summary in 2002 of this 2000 event. So between those three websites, I was able to weed out some of the misinformation that's on the internet and bring you just the facts here. Some other media that I've grabbed screenshots from is a movie called The Command. I used the movie trailer, not the movie itself. So it's all public domain. Also, Project 949 is a great documentary that is on Amazon right now. And I recommend you watch it if you want to know more details about that. They got it pretty close to what actually happened there. And Mr. Gorshank Film, I grabbed a screen grab off one of his films. So thank you to Mr. Gorshank and his film studio that did a documentary on these events. All right. Thank you to all these gentlemen. Really appreciate it. You guys make these sub briefs better, each one of you. All right. Let's talk about SSGNs. In the year 2000, when the Kursk-Hatter incident, there were only three generations of SSGNs, nuclear-powered SSGNs. The first generation was the Echo 1 and 2, of which we have a great sub-brief on. I recommend you watch it. Those were from the 1960s. Very experimental, very revolutionary. The next one was the SSGN Charlies, second generation, built mostly in the 1970s, able to shoot from a submerged position. Unlike the first generation. So big leap forward. And an honorable mention that's not on the screen in front of you is the Papa SSGN, essentially a second generation SSGN as well, but built for speed. So it was made out of titanium, very lightweight. We have a great sub-brief on that. It was the fastest submarine in the world. It beat the Alpha by just about a knot. And not too many people know about it because they only built one. She was too expensive to mass produce. But the Charlie is a cheaper version of that Papa. And that's where you get the second generation SSGN. The Oscar 1 and 2 that we're going to talk about today, is that's what the Kursk was. And they began building her that program in 1975. And they built a bunch of these. And it's a very capable submarine, third generation. And today, in 2021, there's actually a fourth generation. The Yasin essentially is an SSGN because she has a lot of VLS on board her. But we're only going to talk about the Kursk and the Oscar submarines on this one. So real quick, what is the third generation capabilities? What is the Oscar? What's great about this submarine? Well, the first thing is it's 24 missile salvo capability. It can shoot 24 missiles at once in a rapid fire, ripple fire manner to penetrate NATO air defense. It's meant to overwhelm our air defense in our fleets and hit ships with multiple missiles. It has increased stealth. It's much quieter than the Charlie was. It has increased speed. For as big as it is, this thing is fast, man. It's over 30 knots, and it's huge. It pushes a lot of water out of the way when it's going 30 knots. And it has nearly unlimited range because it's nuclear powered. The missiles, though, are very advanced. The shipwreck missiles, also the Russian call them granite missiles. They're very adaptive and flexible. They can have multiple flight trajectories. They had an early version of what we now call data link, where the missiles communicated with each other. Very advanced for the time, honestly. Very, very good stuff. And the Russian designation for this was heavy submarine missile carrier, cruiser rather, designed to kill carriers. So here's the Granite Missile Complex. The missiles that they shoot are the SSN-19, NATO name Shipwreck. And they are huge. So there's two banks of these, one port, one starboard, facing forward, these missile silos. They're canted at about a 60-degree angle. Each missile is 10 meters long, 0.8 meters in diameter. Whenever they are launched, though, they deploy wings that are 2.6 meters whenever they fold out to keep them stable in flight. But it's a very fast supersonic missile, does about 1,500 miles per hour for over 300 miles. So very long range, very fast. And the warhead is just huge. It's like a 1,600-pound warhead. It's ridiculous. If the warhead hits your ship, it's gone. You know, anything smaller than an aircraft carrier is going to go away if it gets hit by one of these things. That's why NATO name called it a shipwreck, because if it hits you, you're toast. And it's designed to kill carriers. The other major weapon system on board, and there are many that we will go over, but the one that we really need to pay attention to is this one, the Type 6576 heavyweight torpedo. It's a 65-centimeter torpedo, and it was first used in 1976, hence the name. That's where we get that NATO name from, 6576. It's a very fast, long-range, wake-homing torpedo with a large warhead. And the cool thing about the wake-homing is it literally can't detect. It's not that it doesn't detect. It literally can't detect noisemakers, decoys, mobile submarine simulator decoys that you may be familiar with. It doesn't even see anything except a ship's wake. As soon as it sees a ship's wake, it starts following it. There's no friend or foe. It doesn't matter whose wake it is. As soon as it hits a wake, it will follow that wake for up to 65 miles at 30 knots. Yeah. And there's nothing you can do to get away from it other than literally outrun it. So if you're going to outrun this torpedo, you're going to embark on a 65-mile journey at 30 knots running away from it. And that, a lot of times, is a victory unto itself because you're causing another ship to react defensively for a long period of time in a specific direction, probably away from where you shot it. And if they can't get away fast enough, they're going to feel the force of that 1,000-pound warhead go off underneath the screws, which is huge. It's a big, big warhead. Now, the Achilles heel of this weapon is its hydrogen peroxide-based fuel. This fuel is very unstable, but they've been operating and handling this weapon for approximately 24, 25 years before the Kursk incident, and they had no serious problems at sea with this fuel, so they continued to use it. Now, they were trying to develop an alternative source of fuel, but they didn't get that alternative in time. And so this is the weapon that's going to be used on the Kursk the day of the event, the day of the exercise, as an exercise weapon. One thing to keep in mind, this 6576 weapon is an exercise shot for today's story, meaning it doesn't have a warhead, but it has all that hydrogen peroxide and kerosene-based fuel in it. And that's going to begin a series of events that leads to the Kursk disaster. So the other weapon systems this Oscar II design can shoot are, besides the Granit missiles, the supersonic cruise missiles, they can shoot the P-800 Onyx missile, which is an anti-ship and land attack missile. It's versatile, can go in either way. They also have the Caliber missile, which is very similar to the NATO Tomahawk missile, similar in looks, capabilities, range, GPS-guided, terrain following. It does all that. And then finally, they're upgrading the Oscar II, and they haven't done this at the time of this recording, but it's coming. They're going to be able to shoot the new Zarkon hypersonic missile from the Oscar IIs. Can you imagine 24 hypersonic missiles coming at your fleet all at once out of nowhere, you know, from just over the horizon, multiple hypersonic missiles? That's going to be terrifying when that day comes. It's not here yet at the time of this recording, but they are working hard now to put the new hypersonic missiles on the remaining Oscar IIs that are operational. In the torpedo room, besides the Fat Girl, the 6576 torpedo, we have the universal torpedo called the UGST. It's basically a Mark 48 is what it. Performance characteristics are very similar to the 1990s version of the Mark 48. They're slowly improving that to make it more like the advanced capability Mark 48 we have today, but they always seem to lag behind a little bit. They also have the VA-111. That's the rocket torpedo that's rather notorious for going some 200 miles an hour beneath the ocean. It runs out in a straight line wherever you want it to go and simply explodes at a range of about 7,000 yards. It often carries a nuclear warhead because it's not guided. It literally goes in one direction for a fixed amount of seconds, about 30 seconds, 7,000 yards, and then blows up. Anything nearby goes away. It can be conventional, but the conventional warhead on that wouldn't be very effective unless they got pretty lucky with a shot. And in addition to that, they have the SSN-16 Stallion rocket-assisted parachute-deployed torpedoes. And this is very important for today's story because while the Kursk is going to go underway in a naval game shooting that big exercise torpedo, she also has war shots on board. So She's got about 14 of these SSN Stallion missiles in the torpedo room at the time of the disaster. Let's take a close look at the sail here. This is a wonderful drawing from Embers of Stern. In the front there, he's got the Swan 11 attack periscope. That's a very narrow optical periscope that comes up above the water and can look around, but it's got a very narrow field of view. You would only use that if you really want to be sneaky and just take a quick peek topside. The more commonly used periscope is the PZNS-10 search periscope behind it. It has a much larger piece of glass on it. It's also very easy to detect on periscope radars. So if you have your Nimrod or your P-3 Orion or your P-8 Poseidon maritime aircraft topside, they're probably going to detect the PZNS search periscope the moment you raise it, which is why you don't want to use that on mission. But it is more commonly used because it's easier for the operator to see things with the larger scope there. Behind that is the escape capsule. Sadly, that doesn't play a role in today's story because it was very near the explosion that's about to happen, so the survivors couldn't get to it. Behind that is the punch bowl. The punch bowl is a pretty fun name for a satellite targeting system called the Coral 81. Essentially, what the SSGN can do is come to periscope depth, raise the punch bowl, connect with the satellite. The satellite already has all the targeting data for them, downloads it. They send it to the missiles, and from periscope depth, they can shoot all 24 of those missiles using that satellite data. They don't need a sonar contact. They don't need a radar contact. They don't need nothing. They raise the punch bowl, they shoot. And that's how devastating this Oscar II can be. From out of nowhere, you know, hundreds of miles away, attack your fleet and sink the carrier. 24 missiles, a lot of missiles to shoot down before it reaches the carrier. Behind that is the radio ESM and HF radio mast, pretty standard mast. There's even two different types of radio mast that you see there. Behind that is the zone radio detection finder. So if they have a strong ESM contact, they can raise the zone radio detection finder to get a bearing to where that radar is coming from. That's how that's used. And behind that is the Center SATCOM. That's for satellite message traffic, transmitting to and from headquarters and whatnot using satellite communications. All right, the Kursk. Let's talk about this. This is the ship we're talking about today. I have a lot of parallels in my naval career with the Kursk that, you know, are pretty interesting. Like, for instance, the keel was laid on 22 March 1990. That's almost the exact day I was sitting down at the Naval Recruiters committing to a six-year enlistment that I would begin April 1st. Like, the very next week I was in boot camp. So she began her life about the same time I began my naval career. She's launched and commissioned in 1994. And in 1995, she's assigned to the Northern Fleet. That's the one at the Kola Peninsula on the Atlantic side of Russia. She spends the next 3 years doing extended sea trials and sonar testing. She has the Shark Gill sonar system, which is the most advanced submarine sonar system they have in the 1990s. And it's pretty capable. It has a lot of different modes. And what they're doing in the White Sea, which is a little body of water south of the Kola Peninsula, where far from the prying eyes of NATO submarines, they're trying all these different active modes and passive modes and just making it better. Basically writing the employment manual, you know, to improve active operations with this. They do that for 3 years. And after that, she finally gets her first deployment in 1999, where she goes down to the Med for 6 months. Down there, she visits all sorts of ports like Syria and I think Libya was one of them, Egypt. A lot of the friendly ports that are more friendly towards Russia at that time than they are today. And during that time, she also trails a U.S. carrier fleet. Now, she didn't do that clandestinely. We knew that she was there. We watched her, but we couldn't chase her away. So she just followed us around and we pinged her a lot and she didn't go away. So what you going to do? And then let's talk about the rescue buoy. So the rescue buoys are these buoys that all these submarines have topside. All the Russian submarines have topside. And they have a manual deployment mode and an automatic deployment mode. And the idea is if there's ever a casualty that sinks the submarine's not able to get to the surface, they can deploy this small rescue buoy that goes up to the surface and it's got a little radio transponder on it. So it marks the position of the submarine and it has a little radio up there that pings SOS or a distress signal of some kind. But they tend to go off on their own. In that automatic deployment mode, they tend to release when they're not supposed to. Like a couple of the categories or symptoms that would cause an automatic release would be exceeding test depth. So if they're not supposed to go below a certain depth and they do, this rescue buoy automatically deploys. That you don't have to do nothing. It just goes on its own. And it's got a little cable that's attached to the submarine, so it doesn't float away. Another thing would be a sudden change in pressure, like an explosion, would automatically release the buoys. And they would just go up and just ping a distress call. So what they do before this Mediterranean cruise is they do a little bead weld on the side of it, welding it to the hull so that it doesn't automatically deploy while they're in the Med for 6 months. This is a very common activity in the Russian Navy because they don't trust these rescue buoys. These ships are built in shipyards. It's coming with the rescue buoy, you know, as per design. And one of the first things they do whenever they go on mission is weld it to the hull, essentially defeating the purpose of the rescue buoy. Well, that's what the Kursk did in 1999. And it's not clear that they ever removed that weld. All right. The summer of 2000. So it's a whole new millennia. Everyone's excited. They just came off a very successful patrol where they tracked the Amerikansky, you know, submarine or fleets, and they're awarded lots of awards. I mean, they are the pride of the Northern Fleet. They get the Best Submarine Northern Fleet Award. They got Hero of the Russian Federation Award. This thing is a legend, right? They're riding high right now. So there's going to be this massive war game in the summer of 2000. And she's going to be a part of it. So in July, she loads exercise weapons, including that big 6576 torpedo, into the torpedo room. And it's fueled up, ready to go, but it's got no warhead, right? It's exercise shot. And the summer of 2000, Naval Group begins the largest naval exercise since the collapse of the Soviet Union. They are going to have everybody here. We're talking Kirov, Kuznetsov, who practically has to be towed there, by the way, because it still doesn't work right. They have Utiloisov, Remedies, they have Grishas, and they also have a couple American subs watching them too. That's right. And a UK sub. Got to give a shout to the UK's or to the Royal Navy. They were there with us. So we have two 688s watching them from afar. We're not near them. We're not in the fleet. We're way over the horizon, just listening. Just keep an eye on what they're doing. And so is the UK. They've got, I think it was a Trafalgar. I might be wrong on that. But anyway, they definitely had a submarine up there. So there are three NATO submarines are watching this huge fleet go to sea and begin operations on the 11th of August of 2000. Underway. So the Kursk enters the targeting area and submerges on the evening of the 11th. On board, she has a lot of VIP guests. We're talking senior officers and admirals from the Northern Fleet Command building, you know, riding the pride of the Northern Fleet ship, the most decorated submarine of 2000, right? They're very, very, very excited to go to sea on the Kursk. Very senior people. And they're going to conduct a missile and torpedo exercise the following day on the 12th. So the 12th of August, this is how it all begins. So 9 a.m., the sun's coming up. The Northern Fleet is at sea. The Admiral Kuznetsov aircraft carrier is there. Technically not an aircraft carrier. It's commonly called an aircraft carrier, but it's like an aircraft carrying battle cruiser is what the Russians consider it. So go with me when I say aircraft carrier on that one, all right? The Kirov-class battle cruiser, Peter the Great, is there. Again, with all the other destroyers that I mentioned before. So the Kursk is at periscope depth now. And they request permission to begin the exercise by conducting a torpedo attack on the Kirov. And this is typical for a naval exercise. The target knows it's going to be attacked, and they're just going to practice, right? So it's not as realistic as you may think. It's very scheduled, and that's normal. NATO does that too. So the Kursk loads the 6576 Fat Girl, is what the crew nicknamed her, torpedo into torpedo tube number 4. That's one of the large 65-centimeter torpedoes on the starboard side of the torpedo room. And at 10 a.m., the Kursk has submerged below periscope depth, so somewhere between 200 feet and the bottom, which is very shallow where she's at. And she's maneuvering around to get into an attack position on the Kirov. So 11 a.m. comes and goes, and the fleet is topside, the admirals with their binoculars scanning their horizon, waiting for the exercise to begin. It's scheduled to begin at 11:40, so they know approximately when it's going to happen. But at 11:30 in the morning, about 10 minutes before the shot was to be fired, the 6576 torpedoes, high-test peroxide and kerosene, somehow mix prematurely. There's a mechanical failure inside the torpedo itself, and that creates a lot of heat. It instantly catches the torpedo on fire and creates a lot of overpressure inside this closed torpedo tube that then explodes, and explodes at the weak point, which is the breach door on the inside of the submarine. The breach door, this big 65-inch piece of heavy metal that's hinged, gets blown off torpedo tube number 4 into the torpedo room, killing sailors, you know, immediately in the path of that thing. But right behind it is this wave of flames that were measured to be burning at approximately 4,900 degrees Fahrenheit. That's extremely hot, and that's because this high-test peroxide kerosene combination is designed to burn very hot, release a lot of energy to push this big torpedo through the water at 30 knots, right? But instead of doing that, it's spilling all that energy into the torpedo room, instantly killing everybody in the torpedo room at these temperatures. Like, those sailors are gone. But what else is in that torpedo room? A lot of war shots with warheads on them, and the torpedo room is engulfed in fire. So the shockwave and fireball kills sailors in the torpedo room. The fire spreads to the 14 other warshot stallions that are in there, and it burns uncontrolled for 2 minutes. Alarms are going off. Everybody knows there's a casualty. There's people dead in the torpedo room. They're getting fire extinguishing agents towards the torpedo room, bringing in fire hoses, CO2 extinguishers if they can get their hands on them. They're doing everything they can to fight the fire. At this point, they know something has gone terribly wrong. You know, the exercise, as far as the Kursk is concerned, is over. We're going to go to periscope depth and call for help. Okay, so they're doing all the initial actions that they need to do to save the ship at this point. And this, by the way, is all being watched by 2 688 submarines and a Royal Navy submarine with our jaws agape. Okay, so the Kursk raises the periscopes in preparation to come to periscope depth. She begins coming shallow. She's hull popping. And then, but she doesn't have time to make any kind of distress calls over the underwater telephone like she could have. Maybe no one thought about doing that. Obviously, there was a lot of panic and surprise going on, but she never made it to periscope depth, and she never made a distress call at this time. At 11:32, just over 2 minutes from the initial explosion, a massive explosion takes place and kills everyone forward of the reactor compartment, essentially. A shockwave that is confined inside the steel hull pulverizes everybody. Machines and men together are spewed together in a mix of metal and blood. It is gone. And that's because the estimated 5 to 7, we don't know exactly how many, but 5 to 7 of those other torpedoes with warheads did explode because they got so hot. It measures 3.5 on the Richter scale. You know, flooding spills into the engine room, okay? The people behind the reactor compartment in the engine room feel the shockwave, but the watertight doors are damaged, but not completely blown open. But water is spilling into where they control the reactors. They have to immediately begin shutting down the reactors because they realize they're going to have to abandon their post or else they're going to drown. So they begin scramming the reactors, and they begin first trying to go forward to see if they could get to the escape capsule, but they can't. They can't go forward of compartment 5, which is the reactor vessel compartment. They can't even open the door to go forward, so they have to go back. And there's no escape capsule aft of the reactor compartment. There's just more engine room. So after the crew shuts down the reactors and the Kursk essentially crashes into the bottom of the 300-foot deep, sandy bottom that they have there, she's basically dead in the water, flooding. And the few survivors that are remaining are running back as far as they can get away from the flooding as this water slowly rises around their feet and then their legs. And they're just trying to find a place to where they can survive until rescue comes. Okay, the Russian fleet responds to the explosion noise that they clearly heard with an underwater telephone signal to surface. You know, Kursk come to the surface. The exercise at this point is suspended when they don't get a response from the Kursk. And a fleet-wide active search begins. Like, all of the surface ships light off their horsejaw sonars. And just, it's a mess of active sonar at this point, as everyone's desperately trying to find what happened and why isn't this Kursk responding anymore? Because something clearly terrible has happened. They luckily have the rescue vessel, Mikhail Rudunsky, with the Kirov during these games. So she's already deployed, puts that ship in a great position to help rescuing any stricken submarine. And there's a picture of her right there. It's 13 August now, and it's 1 a.m. So about 13 hours after that huge explosion, they finally find the Kursk. It is the Horsjaw sonar coming from the Kirov finds a large submerged object on the seafloor that doesn't check with chart. It's not like a seabed object or anything. It's not a previously known wreck. It's an unknown object that's very big, and it's not moving. So they believe they found the Kursk at 1 a.m. At 3 a.m. overhead, they're just listening now. Active sonar's turned off. They hear what they think are metallic knocks from the Kursk. So they think someone's alive at this point, banging on the hull somewhere, trying to get people's attention. Hey, come and rescue us. We're still alive down here. So the rescue vessel readies one of its two rescue submarines, AS-34, to dive. The AS-34 doesn't make it into the water until the following morning. So 10 a.m., she's in the water going down. And at 4 p.m., about 6 hours later, she finally finds the Kursk. She stumbles upon it in the dark, murky water down there and finds the bow is heavily damaged from an explosion, like clearly ripped apart from the inside. Big chunks of steel, you know, pried open like a banana peel it is. And but the sea state is slowly worsening, and AS-34 is damaged during one of these dives as she bumps into the Kursk and also hits the bottom at one point. So she has to surface for repairs before she can dive again. 14 of August, the next day, they know the position. They've marked it on the chart. Everybody knows where the Kursk is at. She's in 300 feet of water. She is nearly level, even though initial reports had her listing at about a 60 degree angle. Those reports were incorrect. So she's level, which is important for rescue. In order to dock another submarine on another submarine, they both need to be level with each other. And so if it's level with the ground, it makes that rescue much easier. They attempt to connect oxygen and power to the submarine. There's special salvage air and salvage water and salvage power connections around each of these escape trunks, is what we have in the Navy, but hatches essentially. Where in the case of a casualty like this, you can at least feed fresh air and even liquid water or soup, if you need to give them calories, to keep stricken sailors inside a sunk submarine alive long enough for rescue to get there. So they initially report that they successfully did that, but it turns out they never connected these oxygen and power connectors. So this is where some of the disinformation online begins, is that they said that they had given the sailors air and water when they had not. And there's no communication now. There's no one banging on the hull in the Kursk anymore as of the 14th. So this is where things begin to not look very good for rescuing anyone. It is 2 days after the incident, and there's no signs of life or activity as of the 14th of August, 2000. The 15th of August, visibility underwater is degrading even further. There's a storm coming in. 15-foot waves topside are common now. And they've made some minor repairs to the rescue submarine, and they're trying to lower it again to see if they can get it docked onto that after escape trunk or the after access hatch to see if they can rescue anybody that might be left alive inside. They do three dives, and they fail three times. And they end up damaging the rescue sub again. Because of the high sea state, it's getting blown around down there by the currents and everything. So the Russian rescue submarine just isn't getting the job done. They're even putting divers in the water at this point. So the 16th comes along, and the word has gotten out. The media is going nuts over the loss of the Kursk here. The families are wondering what's going on, because there's not a lot of public information that's honest that's coming out right now. Russia has, at this point, has already said that there's been an incident and they're recovering the crew and the crew's going to be fine. But nobody really knows that. That's what everybody wants to happen. That's what everybody wants the end to be. But there is no evidence supporting that everybody's going to be fine. So the Russian media begins asking, why isn't the world helping? You know, we're not at war with anybody. We have a stricken submarine. What's going on? And the answer to that is, Russia denied both Norway and the United Kingdom's request for assistance. We were offering them assistance the moment we found out about it, because we had three ships watching this happen. And so we knew about it right away, and we didn't care that they knew that we knew about it, because we were offering help to sailors from day one, and they would not allow NATO countries to come in and help them, essentially. But that all changed on the 17th. Naval leaders and Moscow diplomats like Putin agreed to begin consulting NATO experts. And man, they were there in a heartbeat. They flew three large cargo planes, one that had a rescue sub and the crew and all the equipment, to Norway, where they put it on a ship. And then they sailed that ship up around the Kola Peninsula to the location of the stricken submarine. But it didn't arrive until August 19th. It could have arrived much earlier had they simply accepted NATO's assistance, you know, in the first place, but they didn't. They really missed the window on giving these sailors a chance at this point. So it arrives on August 19th. On the 20th, the following day, the rescue sub finds the UK sub now, finds the Kursk again. It finds the hatch that they're trying to open. We have a special arm on the bottom of this rescue sub that can operate that hatch, but the hatch is so damaged, they're unable to operate the hatch. Can't open it. So what they're going to do now is they're going to send the divers down there 300 feet, and they're just going to cut holes in the hull. And Russians are still adamant about, look, your Norwegian divers can cut holes in the hull, but you can't go in the submarine. You're not allowed. They're still concerned about security at this point, even though there might be survivors inside. So the deal is the Norwegian divers will cut the hull, and then Russian divers will go in and check and see if anybody's alive. So Norwegian divers do that. They go in, they verify that there are no survivors. And this is where it really becomes an absolute tragedy, is after the 21st, because they have to admit there's no longer any other possibility of saving anybody. They've seen the bodies of the surviving, or the people that survived the initial blast, but that are now dead. Putin meets with the families. He goes into complete PR recovery mode. They eventually, even though this isn't offered right away, they eventually offer each of the families $35,000 in compensation. And that is a lot of money in Russia in 2000. And so some people are saying, hey, they're trying to buy our silence. We will not be silenced. You let our sailors, our boys die, essentially, for not accepting help that was offered immediately, is one of their points. But they were compensated $35,000. Which, as I understand it, is multiple years of pay in Russia at that time. The chief of staff of Russia Northern Fleet, Mikhail Matsak, is clearly in distress. He is heartbroken. He goes on national television and begs for forgiveness, essentially, saying that, forgive me for not bringing your boys home, is the translation. He does that on a live broadcast, clearly at the point of breaking into tears. So he was clearly, you know, negatively impacted by this. He wanted to resign right away. He was not allowed to resign until they recovered the Kursk, because one of Putin's promises to the family was, we will bring the boys home. And the families weren't having any of it. They're like, yeah, right, you're just saying that. And so since Putin made that commitment, he would not allow Mikhail to resign. And eventually, he never did. He ended up staying on for much, much longer. On 26 August, Putin awards the crew the Order of Courage, and the captain is awarded Hero of the Russian Federation, posthumously. So the recovery begins. It's not for about another year before they actually get the Kursk recovered. They sign a contract. Russia signs a contract with Dutch marine salvage companies Smit International and Mammut, which has a special ship that is going to be used to raise the Kursk. The way they're going to do this is they're going to drop a tungsten bandsaw, if you will, that's going to pull and push a tungsten cable across the bow section of the submarine, cutting the torpedo room off. And this is a highly controversial move because everyone thinks they're trying to hide something here, but it serves two purposes. There is unexploded ordnance still in the torpedo room that has been set on fire to thousands of degrees and extremely damaged by a shockwave. It is very unstable. Nobody knows if they touch or move these torpedoes if they don't just instantly explode, right? So they're going to cut off the bow so that when they raise the submarine, they're not raising all this high explosive with it. So that's the reason that they're doing that. The reason why that was controversial is there was some speculation that was completely unfounded that this was a collision with an American submarine. And if the collision happened in the bow, there would be evidence of it. So that speculation has since been debunked. But at the time of this happening, not everybody knew the whole truth. Ironically, the people that knew what happened were the American and Royal Navy submarines watching it from afar, which is nuts to think about. So after they cut off the bow with this special saw, they take divers down and they attach dozens of these high strength steel cables and literally weld it to the hull of the Kursk. And that takes, you know, days and days to do this. And there you can see a picture on the right hand side of the special ship, the Maumet, and it has these large hydraulic pulleys, if you will, that will slowly, you know, ratchet the steel cables up, you know, pulling the Kursk off the bottom, breaking that suction, and then slowly raising it to just beneath that barge-like ship. Then they'll take that barge-like ship into a floating dry dock where they will drop, essentially, the Kursk into the floating dry dock with the floating dry dock submerged, right? So the Kursk is still submerged. They will then detach the cables from the Maumet special ship. It will pull out of the submerged floating dry dock, leaving the Kursk in the bottom of the dry dock. Then the dry dock will raise itself up with the Kursk in the center of it, raising it up. So that's kind of the whole process. And this takes months to do. But the Kursk is eventually raised and it's returned to port, where it will be dismantled and scrapped. And the sailors' remains were removed and buried with full honors. So here are some pictures of what I just described to you. There you can see the sail on the left-hand side as it's emerging from the floating dry dock. That's the first time that sail is seeing air since the incident. And you can see the significant amount of damage the explosion did to this enormous submarine. On the right-hand side there, that is one of the shipwreck missiles. It's not clear if it has a warhead or not, because they were going to shoot missiles in the exercise, but you can see the sealant foam they sprayed around it to stabilize the weapon. Because again, these weapons have experienced shock, and so we don't know how stable they are. If they have a warhead, it could possibly go off at any time. And here are some photos from the inside of the submarine. This is what that shockwave did to the men and machines in the forward compartments, forward of the reactor compartment. It absolutely pulverized the inside of the submarine. No one survived that blast. It killed everyone. It would have killed the entire crew had it not been for the reactor compartment, which is a special compartment designed obviously to keep in the radiation, and it's especially hardened against very deep depths. In the case of the loss of the submarine, the reactor vessel will act as a tomb. And it, that construction, that strength, saved the people in the engine room. But anybody forward of that reactor compartment was turned to dust. So here's a great photo of the Kursk sitting in the floating dry dock. Now, you can see where the bandsaw had just cut off the torpedo room there. A very clean cut vertically. Very well done, professional. And then they recovered the rest of the submarine right there. And there are memorials all over Russia for this event. It's such a tragedy. There's memorials in Severninsk, Moscow, Nizhny Novgorod, rather. Sevastopol, Severminsk, and of course the city of Kursk, you know, the name state of the submarine itself. And inscribed on the Kursk memorial is the following quote: "This sorrowful stone is set in memory of the crew of the nuclear submarine Kursk, who tragically died on 12 August 2000 while on military duty." So my final thoughts on this is, I kind of have a unique connection to the submarine because, like I said, we started my career and laid the submarine on almost the same day, which is really weird. But I learned about this while I was underway. I remember exactly where I was when we found out. I was off watch. I was getting ready to come on watch. I was standing in the chow line where we're waiting to go into the galley and grab our food. When word comes down that Russia lost a submarine, we were like, what? You know, and we're underway in the Atlantic, right? And sure enough, the message gets passed around, and it's just a little blurb, official Navy message outlining, you know, there was a anomalous detection, really vague wording about how, you know, this submarine is no longer responding to calls and the Russian Navy is scrambling. And it really blew our mind. And I remember everybody going from being kind of happy and jovial, as we tend to be underway, getting ready to go eat some great food, right, to being solemnly quiet as we handed the little radio message around and we each read it and would make little comments like, wow, you know, I remember someone saying those poor bastards or something like that. It was just a really intense moment for everyone because that could be us, right? That could happen to anybody, right? It's just, unfortunately, it happened to them, you know. And years later, I was able to get onto the CIPRNet, which is the secret internet, basically, and read the ONI summary. That's the Office of Naval Intelligence. It was a TS summary, and they had the audio clips from the two American submarines. I don't know which one I listened to, but I was able to hear the event in real time on headphones, and it was pretty disturbing to hear just because I knew the impact of what I was listening to. And the way we did recordings back then, and it's changed now, but we used to do like 24 different channels. So like you would have 24 audio tracks on one recording. So you could listen to the same recording 24 times and get 24 different sensors, essentially. But one of those sensors is an open microphone that a sailor holds in his hand and talks into it like a game show host, narrating the events that are happening inside the sonar shack. And so after I listened to the explosion a couple times, because that's really all it was, just explosion, and then next thing you know, active sonar is lighting off everywhere. I listened to the audio track of the sonarman, who I didn't recognize his voice, but it was basically somebody just like me, recording. You know, he's recording the before the event. He's like, we have the Kursk tracker, what number, Sierra 1, you know, tracking whatever. You know, Kursk is hull popping, going deep. And then silence. And whenever you're the talker, we call him the narrator, you're never supposed to stop talking, which is really hard to do. Try it sometimes. You'd be surprised how it is to not talk or keep talking when you're supposed to. He goes silent. And that's whenever the explosion happened and he's in shock. And then he comes back from this moment of silence. Like, we just had a large explosion on the bearing of Sierra 1. And then you could hear, because it's an open mic, people are going nuts in the sonar shack. There's like, grab that recording, you know, clip that, because we have all these different tools in sonar to save specific events. And people were just, you could tell they were in shock. And then they were like, oh my God, something terrible has happened. We need to record all this for examination, which is what they were already doing in terms of the entire naval exercise, right? So they were already set up to do this. But whenever that explosion came around, that I'm sure they felt, it was 3.5 on the Richter scale. They must have felt it. They went nuts. And then things kind of calmed down again and everyone got real professional. You would be shocked at how high stress situations focus your mind like a sharp knife. And that happens to submariners, especially when things don't go right. Because you know that you're in a moment where this is what you train for. And it was really interesting for me to hear that narration. Now about the weapon, everybody in Russia especially knew that the 6576 was dangerous to handle. That's why they were coming up with an alternative fuel source for it. But they didn't put the weapon in storage until the new fuel source was out. They continued to essentially toy with Pandora's box here because they had 20 some years of no major incidents. They had gotten lucky over and over again. And then finally, one of the torpedoes, this one on the Kursk, that high hydrogen peroxide fuel just explodes, catches on fire in the torpedo room, and it's a nightmare. And it was just a matter of when was it going to happen, right? And immediately after this, they stopped using the 6576 torpedo until they got a replacement for the HTP peroxide fuel. In 2002, Russian summary cited shoddy equipment, maintenance, and lack of discipline were some of the causes of this, especially whenever it came to the Russian rescue vessels. They simply didn't work. They couldn't connect the hoses. They couldn't provide air or oxygen or food or fuel, not fuel, but a fluid rather, water to the stricken sailors. None of that worked. And so the Russian response in total was just incompetence. and they compounded incompetence with arrogance when they didn't accept NATO's help. You know, it was just terrible. I don't know if NATO would have got there in time, but at least they would have had a better shot than what they had. So something that we remind ourselves of often in the Navy anyway, is that we fight ships, not crews. Like, we're out there to sink the ship, not kill the sailors. Sailors die when you sink ships. There's no question. But once you defeat the ship, you save the crew. And that's why we do this for each other. And so I would leave my last final thought with the families. They deserve better. Their sons deserve better. They all should not have died. It's just such a horrific tragedy that there are now orphans out there, or at least, you know, broken families now with children growing up without dads. And that's a lasting casualty to this. Are those kids. I'd like to say thank you to all the department heads and division officers. Thank you guys by name, as we do traditionally here at the end of every sub brief. JB, been a department head for a long time now. Thank you, man. William R. Collier Jr., you too, sir. Harpoon Henry, I've known Harpoon Henry for years, going way back to the Jive Turkey days. Adam Morgan, thank you, sir, every month consistently supporting me so generously. And I'd like to welcome Kelly Martin. Kelly Martin to the department heads. Thank you very much for being so generous with your Patreons. These categories, this ward room, we call it, goes above and beyond all the other categories, because you get the same thing everybody else gets, but you guys are just so supportive of the channel. We give you the department head honor. Same with division officers. This is hugely generous by all these gentlemen, like Brendan Ferry, DJS4000, an awesome guy. I see him sometimes on the live streams now. It's great to see you here too. Jordan Vazraka, Jeremy Edwards, Noel Rodriguez, Joel Corrent. I'm still struggling with that name a little bit. Jason Wang, the twins, Scott Borg and Sean O'Neill, who are our very first division officers from episode one, are still here. And Josh Warnick, thank you very much. We're doing a lot of live streams now on Twitch. So if you guys, like DJS4000 already does, want to come join us live, please do so. I'd love to recognize you during the live streams as well, because you guys deserve it. And thank you for supporting me. This is a tough one for me to talk about. The sub-brief, the cursed disaster is just gut-wrenching to me. And I think I pulled it off, you know. I had to pause a few times. I don't know if you guys caught on to that, but I had to edit those pauses out. All right. Hey, thanks for being a Patreon. I will have a podcast for you in a couple weeks right here on Patreon, and we'll throw up some photos for you. We'll also have an audio-only version of this available for your mobile devices, and we will see you on that podcast. Check me out live on Twitch, too. You can come say hi Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, okay? Thank you. Bye.